All right, let's prepare ourselves for the continuation of our study of history. And tonight we are continuing the study of the decline of the Persian Empire with the rise of the Hellenistic Empire. And as I told you, what I'm going to do is complete the study of the fall of Persia, even though it'll overlap with taking the Hellenistic Empire, the Macedonian Empire, into its realm of glory. Then what I want to do, if we can finish this tonight, what I want to do then next Sunday evening is to develop for you the development of the Hellenistic Empire and why Alexander the Great had to invent the Koine Greek. But very important tonight, we have the introduction to some new things in military history that were created by the genius Alexander in defeating the Persian Empire. The man lived a very short time as far as a commander of an army, but not only in his victory, which the world is well aware of, but what I want to help you with tonight, or to cause you to enjoy tonight, is what made Alexander the Great so great. So often we know the names in history, and if had to force to just take an exam, we could say that, he was a general of Greece and ruled the world, but few people could outline the realm of the world that he ruled and conquered, and really what made Alexander so great. So tonight you'll find some military things that are still used today and the greatness of this man. Several of the people here, I don't know how many in this class, have asked me about the meeting between Tom Landry and R.B. Thieme. And I'm not going to spend the time in regular classes, but this is my elite class here. And just for a moment, let you in, share some of the things. I thoroughly enjoyed being there, considered it a great privilege, one of those wonderful fragrance of memories in my life. And being with Bob, I've met some very wonderful people, and none equaling the old man, in my opinion. But it worked out where Tom Landry was able to meet with Bob. I was surprised because he wasn't in town Monday of the conference, and his secretary called me and said that she really doubted that he'd be able to. But Tuesday morning, the phone rang, and it said, "Please hold for Tom Landry." And, of course, you can imagine, I went, And but I was poised. You'll appreciate that. How you doing, Tom? He said that he had heard of R.B. Thieme and that he would be honored to meet with him, but he wouldn't be able to. This was Tuesday. And I said, "Well, it's Wednesday and Thursday for lunch, if you can." And he said, "Well, Wednesday." So we met for lunch, and they started talking, and Bob told him I had followed his career and went through the various things that Tom Landry had done. And Bob said, "I had followed you in high school." I was telling a friend all of this, and they in reply said that Tom Landry probably said, "I wondered who that guy was following me around all the time." But then they talked about the games in college when he played at Texas, and they were played. This was the era of the Doak Walkers, Bobby Lanes, Greg Forrest, Tom Landry. And it was just very interesting listening to the men talk and listening to Tom explain. We're on first-name basis now. Listening to Coach Landry talk about the games and become animated at the table. And I enjoyed the way that he would express himself. He said, "I can still see," and different things. And in fact, one play, he said, "I will never forget it. I will remember it probably on my deathbed," he said. "But I was running probably the winning touchdown of the Texas game," and he said, "I tripped and fumbled the ball," and he said, "I remember distinctly looking up, and Bobby Lane was standing there, just standing there holding the ball. He didn't even take it and run. He just stood there gloating that he had my football." And he said, "I'll never forget that." And then we went through various people. I asked Coach Landry, I said that some of my pleasures in life, listening to Bob talk of that era and the games. And Bob was in Dallas Seminary at that time when Landry was playing, and He went to all of the games at the Cotton Bowl and out here at Mustang Stadium on the SMU campus and saw all of the games. And I said, I've enjoyed listening to Bob talk of the personnel of Walker and Lane, yourself, and some of the others. Did you have a sense that your class, that era of those 4 years, that y'all were exceptional, that y'all were making some history? And I enjoyed his reply, and it's something you have to be aware of in the angelic conflict. He said, yes. He said, if you are at all sensed to history, then you know when something's going on. And I thought, how applicable to the royal family of God, that if I could just get the members of North Dallas Bible Church to sense where you are in history and how important you really are in the plan of God. And here's a man that sensed it on a football field, that they were different. They were unique in football. They were a class all their own. In fact, I'm sorry Bob Bolt isn't here, but in fact, Tom Landry said that he felt that the class that he played with, the team he played with, when you consider both total offense and total defense, was the best team the University of Texas ever had, and probably the Southwest Conference in all of its history. And he said, you sense. And I hope that you will apply that in the spiritual realm. Then he went in and talked a little bit about military history, the required number of flights and missions, as they're called, and for a pilot during World War II was 25. Coach Landry made 30 and had a few close calls. He said one, they were in a B-17 and they were approaching and they were out of gas. They had to land. They couldn't find any strip. By the time they broke beneath the clouds and the fog, there was no strip to be seen, and it was all trees because the air strips are surrounded by trees. So he said, we just had to make a crash landing into the trees. We lost both of the wings, tore them off. And he said a big limb was sticking up through the panel. And he said all 10 of us got up and walked away. And he had earlier talked about how he almost went to Houston out from the New York Giants. And so the statement was made at the table that that was two close calls, one in the B-17, and two, he almost went to Houston. So, and we talked about his conversion. It was later in life, 1958, here in Dallas. He was at a men's Bible study that he was invited to at the Highland Park Presbyterian Church. A group of men were meeting, and he accepted Christ there. He takes Christ very seriously. I, of all people, understand the term legalism, and legalism is very evil, and perhaps a little legalistic, but definitely pious. But you have to understand there's a realm of piety that is, if it's your own standard, then that's between you and the Lord. And I try to steer you away from legalism. Is where you think you're doing great things for God, but just having, you want to live a certain pattern of life, that's entirely up to you, between you and the Lord. And he takes his relationship with Christ very seriously. I don't know how much doctrine he knows. I doubt very much just by listening at the table. But I do know that in the realm that he does understand the Bible, that he is a born-again believer and that Christ is very important to him. Ask him about various personnel. I'll go through just a few of them and then we have to get on with our study. But I said, you know, I know you can speak for hours on each of the men, but just a brief coach synopsis of them, I would appreciate it. And I asked him about Vince Lombardi, and he smiled immediately. And he said that Vince was, he said, Vince did not know his X's and O's. And what that means, ladies, is he didn't know the actual mechanics of football, maybe all that well, not near as well as, say, Tom Landry does, or some of the innovators of football. He said Vince dearly didn't know his X's and O's well, but he said that man could motivate a football player to perform at about 50% higher than he was even capable of performing. He just was an unbelievable an inspiration, inspired men to perform on the football field. He said he was an unbelievable competitor. When they were both coaching for the Giants, Tom Landry was the offensive coach. Tom Landry was the defensive coach, and Vince Lombardi was the offensive coach. And if it was obvious that the defense had won the game, he said Vince Lombardi wouldn't talk to him for 3 days. They would pass each other in the hall, and he'd just look the other way. And he said, however, if it was obvious that the offense had done well and won the game, he gloated and act like the defense wasn't even there. But he said he was a great competitor. Asked him about Roger Staubach, and he said that the man, probably one of the greatest, he said there are two greatest competitors he coached was Roger Staubach and Mike Ditka. And he said two entirely different personalities, but he said the men are unbelievable competitors. He said Roger Staubach, he looked at Bob and he said, if we went to the gym today and we started working out, and Roger was there, he'd have to lift more than we do. We're not even competing, but he'd just have to do it. And I was thinking to myself, yeah, and then Bob would want to defeat him, so they'd probably be going up to 600 pounds, break their back, and both die of heart attacks right there. But he said he was just an unbelievable competitor, whatever he did, and he always believed he could win. He said if Roger had 1 second on the board and on the time clock, he just couldn't figure out why he couldn't win. And he said in that great game, the Minnesota game, where he threw the so-called Hail Mary pass, he said, Tom Landry said, Staubach believed he could win. He said, I quit believing. As far as I was concerned, the game was over. He said, Roger running out there on the field, he already knew he was going to win the game. And sure enough, he threw the pass. He said, Hal Pearson caught the ball. I don't know. I've looked at the film 100 times. The ball just stuck on his hip. He said, it just stuck right there. And he said, I don't know how it happened. And talked about the Mike Ditka a little while. He said the man was an animal when he first came to the Cowboys. He said, never met anybody like him in my life. He kind of laughed. He said, you play tennis with him and his racket's an accordion before you've gotten too far into the game. But he said that's what made him so great. He said he's just a competitor, and that's all there is to it. So we went through various things, and it was he went into a little bit of Bob's ministry and what Bob did. And, of course, I was Bob's singer for him. It's hard to sing your own song, so I spoke of Bob. But it was very delightful, and more than that. It was extremely enjoyable and a wonderful memory to listen to the two men speak and talk of various things. And in closing, he talked about the difference in the athlete today, and he said that it's totally different. You've got to pamper them. It's no longer team concept. He said that Vince Lombardi had to get out when he did. He said the team people today, and even in Vince's time, would not submit to that type of discipline. And he said the only reason that Vince got away with it as long as he did was because he was a winner. But he said if he hadn't won, he wouldn't have gotten away with it either. But he said he had to get out because of the personnel of men. And I asked him, well, how do you handle it? And he said, he looked at me and just saw that little smile of his and said, well, I just adjusted, and which is what the great people do. And they adjust to the circumstances. And we'll see that tonight in our study, that when you live a disciplined life, and you have a routine in life, then your adjustment and flexibility adds to the dynamics of your life. But when you do not have it, then you're really in great trouble. But let's get to work now in our study of Alexander and the Roman or the Persian Empire. We have already studied Artaxerxes 465 to 423 B.C., and then this took us into the declining years of the Persian Empire. We studied Darius II, son of Artaxerxes. He was the bastard son, you recall, 423 to 404. We moved on in our study, and we noted the battle of Conexa, and you'll recall that the commanders were both the Persian leaders. One was Artaxerxes II versus Cyrus the Younger, his brother, and the mistake that Cyrus the Younger made. And by the way, Cyrus the Younger bivouacked at Colossae for a period of time as he was preparing for that battle in the area of Greece. All right, so that brings us now to some of the repercussions of the rebellion by Cyrus the Younger. This is where we left off, so let's begin at that point. Is that not correct? Okay. Repercussions of the rebellion by Cyrus the Younger. The Greeks realized that the Persians were divided and vulnerable. The Greeks begin to realize now, the Hellenistic cities begin to realize that the Persians were divided and vulnerable, just as the world today can realize things in reference to the United States. I'll show you some examples of historical examples of when a nation is on the decline and things that characterize all nations, Persia, Greece, Rome, the Constantinople Empire, all the way through history, right up to this very day. There are just various types of instability that characterize a nation on the decline. Skirmishes continued until in 386. Skirmishes continued until 386. Artaxerxes II made peace with Sparta. He made peace with Sparta, and he later established Persian rule over much of Greece. So we're in the point now around 386, dealing with Persia. Here's 386 B.C., and Persia has now pretty well established its power and authority over Greece. So we have the Persian Empire in its power over Greece. However, he met with complete failure in Egypt. He met with complete failure in Egypt. Now independent of Persia. Was now independent of Persia. He also lost control in Iran and in Armenia. Now also at this time, something else began to emerge that you should be aware of. And what began to emerge is something that we have to be historically aware of, and that is the constant increase in taxes. He constantly started to increase the taxes of the people. High taxes started eating away at the people, their life, their attitude. And as the nation began to decline, taxes continued to increase. Striving to maintain a lifestyle gained while it was productive and dynamic. And, of course, the principle is very simple, that political leaders must learn from history. But we have already studied how political leaders never learn from history, and that's a very unfortunate fact. You have to learn from history, and you cannot maintain a standard of living if the money is not there, if the gross national product is not there, if the money is not coming in. This is something that spits my crawl in the state of Texas right now. While our political leaders may not come forth with all of the immorality of someone like Gary Hart, in my opinion, the immorality of the leaders of Texas far excels that of Gary Hart and his affair with Rice. Because what they're doing is the political leaders of Texas are raping or committing adultery or whatever you want to call it, the people of Texas. When the money is not coming in, all they can do is raise taxes to try to maintain a standard of living. The money isn't there. And this is something you have to learn in your own personal life. You have to learn to make adjustments. And if you cannot maintain a standard of living, arrogance will cause you to destroy yourself. Genuine humility simply says, look, the income is lower, therefore taxes are going to have to be lowered. But we do not understand that, and we continue to raise taxes. We do not learn. Persia is on its way down. Continuing, his control in Greece was dependent upon Greek discord. And that is the city-state still fighting each other, factions. And in 366, and just remember, Alexander the Great will come into play around 335. In 366, the Greek city-states began to fight together. They began to form an alliance. In fact, there was an alliance formed between Athens and Sparta, the two enemies of the Peloponnesian War. Athens and Sparta and Egypt. And there was nothing that Artaxerxes could do about it. Athens and Sparta, the two enemies of the Peloponnesian War, which ended in 404 B.C., now become allies along with Egypt. And there's nothing Artaxerxes can do. Remember, Egypt has already won its independence of the Persian Empire. Now, to show you a quirk of history, however, and how horrible things are, but soon the alliance between these city-states began to break down by distrust and treason. In other words, the love of their own cities caused the city-states of Greece, like Sparta and Athens and other cities, to distrust each other, and therefore the alliance broke down. By the time of the death of Artaxerxes in 359, some people 358, I'm not going to pin you down on those kind of things, just give you a feel of what's happening. At his death in 359, 358, the Persian influence and control was still dominant in Greece. Not so much due to the power of Persia as to the internal rivalries of Greece. Now, one note you want to put down in your notes at this time. One major change took place in Persia under Artaxerxes. One major change took place under Artaxerxes in its decline. Up to this point, the Persians did not set up and worship images of gods. Now, they had their idolatry, but they did not worship idols, images. But under Artaxerxes, he set up images of goddesses throughout the land to be worshipped. And you'll recall that Artaxerxes was a weak man ruled by his wife and his mother, and this was probably, historians say, due to their strong influence over him. So he immediately had, or not immediately, but he over the years had put up images throughout the Persian Empire, images of goddesses to be worshipped under the influence of his mother and wife. You have the very strong, and I'm sorry, ladies, it's a fact of history, and I've got to report it. You have a very strong influence, a female influence in politics and in power as nations decline. You recall we studied this in the book of Isaiah, how this characterizes the weakening and decline of a country. And the mother and his wife ruled poor Artaxerxes. All right, one final push at glory. One final push at glory is what we'll call this last part. Before its final fall, Persia enjoyed one more period of power, brief but glorious. This will be under Artaxerxes III, A-R-T-A-X-E-R-X-E-S, Artaxerxes III. Artaxerxes III became king of Persia and determined to rule the empire with the greatness and strength of Darius the Great. He will rule from approximately 359 to 338. Aha, 338. If you're thinking, whenever you come into that period, you want to think of Philip of Macedon, the father of Alexander. So you'll have a feel of already what's getting ready to happen in history. All right, so we have Artaxerxes III, and he wants to rule with great power and give back the glory that Persia once had. He was the son of Artaxerxes II, and there are some very interesting and important things to happen. Let me just go through this under point form. Under Artaxerxes, we just noted things along the way. But now with Artaxerxes III, let's note this so that you can keep a running thought of what's happening in history. Point one, he began his rule or his reign by murdering all of his own brothers and sisters. Oh, now that clears the board. He began to rule by murdering immediately all of his own sisters and brothers. And there were several dozen of them. And he just executed everybody. There wasn't going to be any more of this inter-family squabble trying to gain the throne like Cyrus the Younger and Artaxerxes the Father, or the Artaxerxes II. Remember, they had their battle. And Cyrus the Younger led a rebellion. He was the brother of Artaxerxes II. Well, Artaxerxes III says, that's a bunch of nonsense. I'm not going to have my family trying to kill me and want my throne. Best thing to do is just murder them all. So he executed his entire family. Point two, he was ambitious and highly energetical, or had a great deal of energy. He was highly energetic. This man was one of those people who will always be doing something. He felt that things had gotten so bad and so out of hand that the Persian Empire was declining in history, that he was going to have to be tough, even cruel if necessary, to regain its position in the world. Now, here's a principle for you. We're here to learn not only of the period between the Testaments, but we're also here to learn some things about history from history. And this is something you will see occurring throughout history. As a nation declines, its leaders and its laws become more and more strict and cruel. As the nation declines, taking more and more from the people, higher taxes, stricter laws, trying to hold on, trying to regain, and therefore become very strict. This is what happens when people are losing control. When a man senses that he's losing control over his children, he finds himself becoming more of a tyrant, becoming more strict in the rules, discipline, and all of these things. When a man finds himself losing control of his wife and his home, he finds himself becoming more cruel and more vicious. And while we can certainly understand the frustration, there is no justification for it. And once this thing starts happening, there's really not much you can do. And that's why, as I told you before, the woman's paragraph is always placed first. Because if the woman does not choose to submit, the woman refuses to submit to the authority of the husband, there's really nothing the husband can do. He can't just come in and beat her up and lock her in a closet. That's totally out of line. Only an infidel, a petty jerk, hits a woman. It's just something you do not do. But when you start losing control of your wife and control of the circumstances, people tend to become cruel. And this is true politically, this is true personally, and you just have to be aware of it. And if these things are happening in your life, you just simply have to handle it another way, let it go, and adjust yourself for whatever you have to do. Point three, Artaxerxes III tried to regain control of Egypt, which had been independent since 404, right after the Peloponnesian War. The Peloponnesian War ended in 405. Now, there are certain things, and what I'm going to do, I'll just tell you right now, I don't know, I'm in no hurry, I'm here to teach. And what I'm going to do over the week is go back over to Persia, and I'm going to pick out about five or six highlights that I want you to have in your mind. There are certain things you want to remember. A lot of things is good for information and enjoyable. But they're just things you have to remember. And the Peloponnesian War is one thing that you don't have to be frightened of. Just remember, it's at the last half of the 5th century, about 437 to 405 B.C., and it was a battle between Sparta and Athens. And that's basically what the Peloponnesian War is. Now, a lot of the details are absolutely fantastic. As I told you Thursday night, there is even some who believe a woman was part of the problem and the cause of the war, the woman who influenced Pericles, Aspasia. But she's a very wonderful woman, and I don't think she deserves that in history. But we'll study Aspasia, we'll study Pericles, and the Peloponnesian War in our study of Greece. But so since 404, Egypt has been free. And so he tried to regain control of Egypt, and he failed. So he failed in trying to gain control of Egypt. Now watch what happens, though, very quickly with a man who doesn't give up and a man in control and that has a high profile as far as motivation is concerned. Point four, due to this failure in 351 B.C., Philip of Macedon is starting to rise to power now. Things are going on. But due to the failure in his attack of Egypt, the Phoenician towns began to revolt. Now, look what's happening here. We have maps. So let's use our maps since we have maps.
All right. Let's see here if this is going to help us. Nope, this isn't going to help us. Well, what we have, I'm sorry I didn't get them out, but what we have, here will be the Mediterranean coastline like this. Here's the Persian Gulf. Here's the Susa, the Persian Empire. You come around. Here's Asia Minor. You come up. And up here is the Black Sea. Well, all of these cities. Here's the Phoenician cities. And you remember the city-state of Tyre from our study in Isaiah. Sidon. And all of these city-states in here decided, since he lost in his battle with Egypt, that they were going to rebel. And they weren't going to pay taxes, and they weren't going to do anything, and they were going to rebel. So watch what this man does. Now, he's taken his army down here, and he's lost. And I'm not going to take time to go through some of those battles with you. They're not that crucial in our study. So he goes back, and so the Phoenicians decide they are going to revolt. And in 345 B.C., he built a great and powerful army and led his army against Sidon, destroying the city. I mean, he destroyed, and you recall we studied how powerful Sidon was, and he destroyed the city-state of Sidon. Point five. He then took his army and for the second time moved against Egypt. He then took his army and moved against Egypt in 343 B.C. 343 B.C. Now, just be able to think with me now on a map. All of this is going on in this area here with Persia. That leaves over here the Hellenistic Empire pretty much alone. He is thinking of what's going on down here. Now, that leaves the Rome for a man to start coming to power named Philip. And Philip is going to start consolidating the Greeks and building a rather powerful army himself during this period. And there's not really anything because he's over here fighting the Phoenicians and fighting Egypt and establishing more local control over his empire. So he can't stop what's going on. And up here, a phenomenon is occurring that's very important in history. Philip of Macedon, the father of Alexander the Great, is building a great army during this time period. So, 343, he now moves against Egypt, and this time is most successful. This time he is most successful. He destroys a great number of cities of Egypt. He destroys a great number of the temples, robbing the temples of their wealth. And as legend always has associated with such men, it is said that he killed Apis the bull with his own hands. He met Apis the bull out on the road, and he encountered Apis the bull, that's the god of Egypt, and he encountered Apis the bull. You remember the bull, that's what the Israelites made their golden image of when Moses was up receiving the Ten Commandments. That's the god of Egypt, and it's very important to the entire study of Egypt. So he is given credit, Artaxerxes III, for actually encountering Apis the bull on the road and defeating him with his bare hands. He then returned after conquering the Phoenicians and conquering Egypt. He returned to Susa, the capital of the Persian Empire, to rule his empire. Now, a lot of things are going on. He's going to put up different men in head of different areas. Point six. Then Philip of Macedon. Philip of Macedon has built his army now and is going and attacks the Byzantine Empire, or the city of Byzantine. And that we do have on this map. So let me put this one on the board, because you can now start seeing some things that are developing in history in regard to our study. All right, what we have now is we have the city-state of Byzantine right here. And then, Philip has moved his army from this direction, has come across over, and has attacked now the city of Byzantine and another city named Perinthus, P-E-R-I-N-T-H-U-S. Now, Perinthus, if you'll follow along with me, you come down through here, and Perinthus is right, see this little loop right here? Well, Perinthus is right here. So he takes his army, and he attacks both of these forces of Asia Minor. So then Philip of Macedon attacks these cities. Artaxerxes sends gold and aid to these two cities. So Artaxerxes can't send any army, but he does send from his Persian Empire, he does send gold to the Byzantine and to Perinthus to help them against Philip of Macedon. Now remember that, because that's going to be Philip's reason for attacking the Persian Empire. All right, so he sends aid. Now, point seven. In 338 B.C., Artaxerxes was assassinated by one of his very close friends and chief of staff. So much for loyalty. But that's what you'll find in the declining empire. You will not find loyalty. What you're going to find in a declining home, a declining church, a declining business, you'll find all of the people start turning on each other like you can't believe. And when you start weakening in a home, weakening in an empire, weakening in a business, weakening in a church, and there's problems, you'll find no loyalty. People do not have character, generally speaking. People do not have character under pressure. So he was assassinated, poisoned, by his chief of staff, who also murdered the king's older sons. He poisoned them. And then he promoted Artaxerxes' youngest son to the throne. Arses. A-R-S-E-S. Now you may wonder, why would a younger son even take the throne, knowing that the man has poisoned his father and his older brothers and all? All right, let's go to Arses very quickly. Arses will rule from 338, November, if you want to have an idea. November of 338 to June of 336. Not a great deal is known of the man or of his reign. Due to the decline of Persia, and Philip of Macedon is on the increase in power. During this reign, Philip invaded Asia Minor with the stated reason being that Arses refused to make reparation to Philip for the financial aid to Perinthus and Byzantine. In other words, Philip was successful against Perinthus and Byzantine and came on across in both places, Hell's Point. He came on across and invaded Asia Minor. And the reason for all of this was because Persia would not repay him and make amends for supporting Byzantine and Perinthus during his invasion. So that was the reason for it. Arses, very quickly, laid a plan to poison the man who killed his father, but was unsuccessful and was killed himself by poison, along with all of his children. Guess poison was the going way to do it back then. And rather than being able to poison the man, by the way, his name is Bagoas, if you want to name your dog or something, or have a dirty name to call somebody, Bagoas. You can call him, you Bagoas. And they won't know what it means, but it sounds terrible, and it is terrible. So Bagoas is a good dirty word for you. Bagoas was the man's name. You know what? I think some of you probably remember that name more than you will some of the other kings of Persia. You'll remember Bagoas. All right, that's the way it is. The evil always remembered. All right, but Arses laid the plans. He himself was murdered, and along with all of his children. The man Bagoas then appointed another man who took the name Darius III as ruler. Now, this is the end of the Persian Empire. This brings us to the last king of the Persian Empire. This brings us now to the last king of the Persian Empire, Darius III, 336-330 B.C. 336 to 330 B.C., and with this, the rise of course, Alexander the Great. All right, I will give you this in point form because this is the decline of this great empire. I'm going to do this in an outline form for you. But just note now, while all of this is going on in the world, Egypt or Israel is being left alone, and they don't take advantage of it. They're intermarrying. They are developing a legalistic air bodies like the Pharisees and the scribes. They are doing everything that they shouldn't do in reference to the opportunity they now have. They now have an opportunity because nobody really cares about them. Persia's too busy with Egypt. Persia's too busy with Greece. Greece is too busy with itself. Egypt's just trying to get by. What a wonderful opportunity for this little country caught in the middle of all of this to take advantage of it and prepare itself for the coming of the Messiah. But instead, they become very smug, very arrogant, and develop a system and leadership of evil that by the time the Messiah comes, they're not prepared. But I'll put all of that in its perspective. It's difficult because what we could be doing all the way through this is what's happening because the scribes and Pharisees are starting to come into existence and all of that, but I feel like you get lost. I don't know the best way. But my idea, the way I think, is let's get a good feel of what's happening in Persia. Then we'll get a good feel of what's happening in the Hellenistic Empire. Then we can come back and get a good feel of what's happening in Israel. And then you can kind of cross all of these things on your own. But that's just the orderly way I know to do it, is to develop a thought all the way through, then another thought all the way through, and then another thought. And then we can come back and you can cross them and see what's happening. All right, Darius III, 336 to 330. One. Once he became king, he asserted his independence of Bagoas, B-A-G-O-A-S. B-A-G-O-A-S. He asserted his independence of Bagoas. Bagoas, who now had poisoned the last two kings, this man's father and grandfather, tried to poison Darius. Well, excuse me, this is not their father. Darius is not the son. He's another man that's related to the family. But he tried to poison Darius. Now, Bogus has already poisoned the last two kings, and now he tries to poison Darius, who in turn forced Bagoas to drink the poison instead. And so that's the end of Bagoas. If anything else, Darius III got rid of Bagoas. Point two. Philip of Macedon. And when we come, I'm not going to give you too much about the personalities and some intriguing stories about the ladies and the battles and the things. We'll do that when we come to Greece, where it fits in. I only want to cover Greece as it relates to Persia in this class. Philip of Macedon, in 337 B.C., formed the League of Corinth. And that's, of course, Corinth that Paul will later write to. He will form the League of Corinth for the purpose of liberating the Greek cities from all rule and all influence of Persia. In 337, Philip, the father of Alexander, formed the League of Corinth. You have a great number, and I'll get to this later, you have a great number of great writers at this time in history we have two great writers, and I'll study that. We'll note those, not study them. Two opposing views of Philip. Some say that Philip was evil, tyrannical type of man and all of this, hung mad for power. And other people say that the man was a genius and he loved Greece and he wanted to build Greece into a great empire. So you can just kind of read whoever you want and draw your own conclusions. Myself, he's a genius in history, and his son learned a great deal from Philip. But Philip decided to form the League of Corinth for the purpose of liberating Greece, all Greek cities, from the rule and influence of Persia. In 336, he sent his army into Asia Minor. Point three. But in July of 336, Philip was assassinated. In July of 336, Philip was assassinated. It is speculated that Darius III, ruler of Persia, instigated the assassination of Philip. And of course, all history, there's no proof in it, but all things look as though he did, and that would fit right in line with his modus operandi. And we know that he paid other people in that area, Greeks, and there were a great number of Greeks who were in his mercenary army, that is, the mercenary army of Persia. And so it fits into the history. Be that as it may, Philip is assassinated in 336, July of 336 B.C. And again, it was speculated Darius III had part in it, but only to turn loose one of the greatest military geniuses in history. Point four. In the spring of 334, Philip's son, Alexander the Great, led his army across Hellespont into Asia Minor. Point five, Darius had made no serious military preparation to resist Alexander's invasion. Alexander will defeat the Persian mercenary army at the River of Granicus, G-R-A-N-I-C-U-S, at the Battle of Granicus in 334 B.C. Now, you've got to get ready for some fun in history, so let's, some enjoyment of history, and these are the things you want to remember now, because it is at this battle and the next battle that we have a couple of the things introduced into military history that had never been perfected before by Alexander the Great. And therefore, I'm going to spend a moment on the Battle of Granicus, because it is a very important battle in history as to what's happening in military history. Why Alexander's Great? Now, some of you may have a good background. I'll be honest, I didn't have a great background years ago. Bob would talk about Alexander. Of course, you knew from him in school. But these are the types of things. And I want to show you a very brief period of history what made this man so great and how he was able to forge his way into the military genius category. And it wasn't just a matter of being a great leader. It was a matter of being a genius in military strategy. And that's what makes him one of the five greatest generals in all of military history. And so let's take a look at the Battle of Granicus, and so we can see what is happening in Granicus. Now, what we have, if you look at the map, now what we have is, here is Hellespont. And you come across Hellespont, and right up here is a river. Right here's a river, and at Granicus. And this is where, and it's a rather deep river at various areas, and this is where this battle is going to be fought. Let me give you, as is our normal procedure with battles now, we've developed this, and I'm going to carry it through for the enjoyment of studying these things, not get bogged down, and study so you can enjoy the battle. First of all, the facts. First of all, the facts. Alexander's cavalry, 5,000. The Persian cavalry, 15,000. Alexander's heavy infantry, 22,000. The Persians' heavy infantry, 7,000. Alexander's light infantry. Now, I hope that you've remembered our study of light infantry, the things that were learned by Xenophon in the use of light infantry as opposed to the hoplite or the heavy infantry of Greece. Greece was predominant in having the heavy infantry. That's why Persia was able to defeat the Greeks under Xenophon when they made their move toward Persia, because they had the hoplites. They had the very heavy weighted down infantrymen, where Persia had the lighter, more mobile infantry. Xenophon learned all of that, you recall. Xenophon went back and put it all down. That's what made Xenophon so important to history, leading the 10,000 Greeks, as we studied, I think it was just last Sunday night. And he wrote all of that down, and that's what made him so great. Philip learned from Xenophon. Alexander learns from Xenophon and from Philip. So, under Alexander's light infantry, he will have 1,500 javelins, 1,500 javelins, 5,000 archers. Excuse me, 500. What a difference. 500 archers. The Persians will have light infantry of 7,000, predominantly archers. So you can see the balance and the disbalance in the various areas of the armies. All right, the battle situation. This is the way we've been doing it. And I briefly set the scene for you before we get to the battle. So we have the battle situation. One, after marching into Asia Minor across Hellespont, which is right here He marched across here now. He's into Asia Minor now. This is the port of entrance throughout history. We've seen it several times referred to in our studies. After marching into Asia Minor at Hellespont, Alexander could not advance southward until he had disposed of the Persian army to his left. All right, so what he would like to do is move on down southward, see, on the map. He wants to move on down southward. But here is the Persian army at this point. So he has now got to take care of the Persian army rather than leave it behind him. So he's got to take care of the Persian army. Now, this will be a battle we will not study when we come to the study of Greece, because we will study it with the fall of Persia. All right? Point two. Alexander moved his army towards the Persian army along the Granicus River. Now, what he learned, you can write it if you want, but what he learned was that the army had decided that they would fight him at the Granicus River. And that's where they were going to plan on moving all of their forces. Now, the forces were not there yet. And this is very important to history. The forces were not there yet, but Alexander learned through reconnaissance, G2, which I'll make a point about that in a moment, that's what they were planning on doing. So what he immediately did, he immediately turned his army to beat them to the river. Okay? Now, they're not there. The Persian army isn't there, but he's learned what they want to do is dig in on the far side of the river and defeat Alexander's army. So he's learned that. So he immediately has his army turned. All right, point three. He sent out scouts, reconnaissance. This was very important. The use of scouts and lookouts had in the past been neglected, much neglected, by Greek commanders. And this goes back for almost 1,000 or 2,000 years. Greek commanders have not utilized lookouts and scouts. History records that Athens may have won the Peloponnesian War had they used lookouts and scouts. But they didn't, and they lost. Alexander, however, had been trained in his father's army and by his father, and his army, Alexander's army, operated like a scientifically designed war machine. Alexander's army operated like a scientifically designed war machine. All right, a principle in regard to your own life. Your life and the spiritual conflict that you are involved in should be composed of discipline. You should plan ahead, look ahead. Your life should have structure and order. There should be reasons for what you do in life. This often is the difference between existing and living in life. You will find that people who succeed in life are people who are disciplined and generally have a plan. And this gives them great ability to being flexible to their advantage. And that's the key. Not just flexible. Anybody can be flexible. You know, you can take a kid. Kid can be flexible. Do you want to study? No, I don't want to. I'm flexible. You know. But that isn't flexibility. Flexibility, remember that word means the flexibility carries with it the idea, or should, to your thinking, the idea of doing things to your advantage, being flexible to where it works out for your advantage, not your disadvantage. That's a loser. But flexibility means that you can adjust quickly and handle things to your advantage. And when you have a disciplined life, believer, you will accomplish great things in life and enjoy much more in life. When your life has a plan and a design, and you know what you're doing in life. Someone was talking to me in regard to Thursday night's class when we went over some of the great romances of history. Well, every person's love relationship between a man and woman can be a great romance. You just have to put forth the effort. You have to put forth the planning. You have to put forth the thought. Same thing with everyone's life. Unfortunately, many people, born-again believers, are going to go through this life and just go through it. And no real dynamics to their life, no plan, no goals, no objectives, And people say, well, I'm not important, and well, a big deal, I got, you know, I make $18,000 a year. Now, what kind of planning am I going to do? I'm not talking about doing great things in that area. I'm talking about getting the most out of your life, taking full advantage of everything and anything you do. And people who are organized and disciplined and trained and will structure their life get a lot more out of life. And many people, just in their own homes, I mean, I'm not going to start preaching on this, but people in their home, you're not organized, so you spend time looking for things, and you spend time doing this, and you spend time doing that, and then you don't want to do this, and you don't want to do that. No discipline, no structure, no organization, no plan. And therefore, you get very little out of life. People who plan things in life, accomplish things in life. What makes these men great, and the women great? These are people who planned, who understood what was going on. Now, they're flexible when they have to be, to their advantage, because they have organization and a disciplined life. Well, we're over time, and I'm sorry, because I wanted to hit this battle, but this gives us next Sunday night. We can complete in one lesson what's going to happen to Persia and start our study of the development of the great Hellenistic Empire. So let's close now in a word of prayer and prepare ourselves for a study of Galatians. Or of Colossians. Well, Galatians. Well, couldn't you see it? I'd be stoned if I got up and said, open the Word of God to Galatians tonight. All right, let's close in prayer. Father, how grateful we are for a principle of doctrine that we noted this morning. That Jesus Christ, our Savior, your Son and the Son of Man, is resurrected and ascended and now sits at your right hand. He is in total and full control of all history. And we know, Heavenly Father, there are no accidents in history. There are no accidents in the battles of history. And there are no accidents in our own lives. And so, Heavenly Father, it is our purpose to take full advantage. We know that we can make bad decisions. We know that we can make decisions that are in opposition to your plan. But we also know, Heavenly Father, that as long as we take advantage of our relationship with Christ, even bad decisions can be turned around. And we must realize we are here for a purpose. How insulting it is to us, Father, as we study a man like Alexander the Great, who probably wasn't even a believer, but he was a man who sensed destiny. He was a man who sensed his own importance. He wasn't a coward. He didn't hang on to life. He was very courageous. But he understood he had a place. How much more important is it for each of us tonight, Father, to understand through your word that we are even more important than Alexander, that we are more important than any of these people, that we have within our power and our ability and capacity to reflect the glory of the Son of God. It is so important, Father, that we understand who and what we are, where we are in history, that we have crossed Hell's Point, the cross, and we must make our impact in history. To this end, Father, we do pray in Christ's name. Amen.